today in the show, both hours of the show, we'll be talking with the authors of two new books just out, books intended to be companions that explore the history of the Democratic and Republican parties here in the United States. And in the first hour, we will be talking about the Democrats. Our guest is Jules Whitcover. He's a journalist. He's been covering American politics and the Democratic Party for a long time as a reporter, a syndicated columnist, and author. He has written 10 books on politics and history. He also attended every Democratic convention since 1964 and has written about every campaign between 76 and 92. He's written on national politics for the Newhouse newspapers, the LA Times, the Washington Post, and since 1981, he's been a political columnist for the Baltimore Sun. He is the author of the book Party of the People, A History of the Democrats. It's published by Random House. It's just out now, so you certainly should be able to find it in the bookstore. In the second hour of the show, by the way, we'll be talking about the Republicans, and our guest there will be Lewis Gould. He's a professor emeritus in American history at University of Texas at Austin. So hope you can stay with us throughout the morning for both shows. And of course, as we talk, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief when they call in so that we can make room for as many people as possible, keep the program moving. Anyone's welcome to call 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana folks. If you're listening around Illinois and Indiana over the air, or if you might happen to be listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, use the toll-free line 800-222-9455. Mr. Whitcover, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure.
We appreciate it. I think that, you know, something right away that's very striking about both parties, both the Democrats and the Republicans, is the extent to which, over time, the positions of the parties have changed. And, in fact, the Democrats began, they were the party when they started out of states' rights and small government, and it had a very rural base. And now, of course, they are the party of urban liberals. They're the party of African Americans. They're the party that believes in strong central government. That's a, it seems over time, a fairly remarkable change.
That's true. That's exactly what happened. The Democratic Party really began in the South, in rural America, in frontier America. And its founder, Thomas Jefferson, was a champion of those regions. Was a strong believer in states' rights, and although he owned slaves himself, said he was against slavery. But of course, that change came about much later.
One thing, though, that I think is also true, and I think the same thing is true on the Republican side of things, is that while the parties change their positions on some very important issues, the thing that didn't really change as much, say with the exception of moving of African Americans from being Republicans to being Democrats, the thing that didn't really change very much is what the base of the party was. And the reason that the party changed its positions was that the core of the parties changed the way they thought on things, and the changes of the party's platforms and their positions just mirrored the changes in their base.
Yes, that's true. But at the same time, the Democratic Party, which ironically was called the Republican Party at the outset, and eventually was changed to the name Democratic Republican, and then eventually Democratic. It always strove to be, as the title of my book conveys, the party of the people. Conveyed the sense that it was the supporter of the little man. That was true in Jefferson's days, focus on the farm communities in the South and the frontier, and then certainly when Andrew Jackson became president, with a strongly populist tone to his views and administration. So the party always sought to sell itself as the common man's party.
Yeah, and probably again one of the ways that the base changed in nature was that the working man shifted from being an agrarian, being a farmer essentially, or perhaps an artisan, to an urban industrial worker. So as that change happened, then the party again in some of its attitudes changed as a result.
Yes, the growth of blue collar workers in industrialized America brought also a geographical shift. In that industry was most strongly located in the north and in major cities with a very large immigration into those cities. The blue collar party became strong in the north as a result of those developments. Hmm.
As you say, it's a little confusing when you read this history because early on the Democrats, they didn't call themselves Democrats. In fact, they called themselves Republicans when you're going back to Jefferson. And it wasn't until, as you point out, it wasn't until Andrew Jackson. I think he was the first Democrat actually to campaign for the presidency as calling himself a Democrat, as a Democrat.
Yes, the name Republican was first introduced in a letter from Jefferson to then President Washington. And it was assumed that the name Republican was chosen by Jefferson because he had strong loyalties to the French Republic. He had been American ambassador to French and was much impressed by the French, and took that name. As a matter of fact, in those early days, that party, what became the Democratic Party, what was then called the Republican Party, was often referred to as the French Party, and the Federalists, the opposition party, which believed in a strong central government, and even its leading light, Alexander Hamilton, wanted to have the president elected for life along the lines of a monarchy. So in those early days, we had what was called a French Party and an English Party.
I am fairly confident that. You know, on the list of influential Democrats, I would certainly would have to put Thomas Jefferson on that list. But I'm certain that Andrew Jackson would have to be on that list as well. And that with his presidency, a lot of things changed. That some people would point to that as the beginning of the modern campaign, and also that perhaps the introduction of populism at that time was something that was very important for shaping the party. Talk about Andrew Jackson.
Well, Jackson did, although himself grew to be an aristocrat, a very wealthy man, conveyed the image of being a man of the people and a man of the countryside. As a hero, a war hero, much was made when he ran twice, first the time he lost, second time he won, of his rural roots and his military background, and led to a lot of hoopla, torchlight parades, and that sort of thing that we came to associate with campaigns. Interestingly, though, at that time and for quite a while later, candidates themselves did not campaign. It was considered either beneath them or not, just not proper. For the candidates who were seeking the presidency to speak out in any way, but in place of that, we had a lot of as I say, torchlight parades and slogans, and eventually bumper stickers, not on cars but on buggies, and all that kind of stuff that we come to us to take for granted now in presidential campaigns.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jules Whitcover. He's a journalist, has been covering American politics for more than 50 years. He's the author of a newly published history of the Democratic Party, and it's titled Party of the People, a History of the Democrats. It's published by Random House, just out now. It's one of two new books exploring the history of the parties. There is also one that looks at the history of the Republicans, and we'll be talking about that in the second part of the show. Questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455. That's for folks here in Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. From Jackson on, for a number of years, the Democrats had a lot of success. But the thing that really tore the party apart and laid the groundwork for the election of the first Republican, who was Abraham Lincoln, the thing that really caused that stress and eventually a kind of a split in the Democratic Party, that was slavery.
Yes, there were tensions other than slavery between the North and South for years, but it really was at the core because the free labor that the South enjoyed gave them advantages, economic advantages, or at least the North Northern people saw it that way. When during Jackson's time, the South Carolina sought to nullify some laws that it felt were tariff laws that were disadvantageous to the South. There was an attempt to pull out of the Union that didn't make it because no other state would join South Carolina. But at the core of it was always the question of slavery. And as during this time and years later, up to the Civil War, when more and more states were created, there was always a fight over whether that state would be free or slave, and ultimately culminated in the secession of the southern states and the creation of the Confederacy, which in turn led to the Civil War.
Mm. Something really interesting happened around this point, and that is there was a real split within the party between Northern Democrats and Southern Democrats, and they actually had two candidates for the presidency, and ending up splitting the Democratic vote, and that may indeed have a lot to do with the election of Abraham Lincoln.
Well, certainly. There was one election that really took place in the South between two Southerners, and the main campaign, which was between Lincoln and Stephen Douglas, was the deciding election. But out of all that came a severe split in the Democratic Party. Upon election, Lincoln, faced with the beginning of the Civil War, tried to bring Democrats in who would support the Union, and he temporarily changed the name of the new Republican Party to the National Union Party and invited so inclined Democrats to join. The Democrats who did that came to be known as the War Democrats, and the remainder, those who wanted to maintain the Democratic Party as an alternative to Lincoln, were known as the Peace Democrats. That split continued through the Civil War, and then afterward, the Peace Democrats were kind of the basis for trying to rebuild a Democratic Party that was severely shattered by the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. It seems there was a fairly long period here where the Democrats were in the wilderness, about four decades, I think, perhaps longer than that. And it wasn't really until Franklin Roosevelt came along that the party really became huge, strong, influential, and then that continued for a long time, and I suppose a lot of that was in response to people's feeling that the Republican Party had not done enough about economic conditions in the country, and so for that reason that they turned to the Democrats. Can you talk a little bit about that period there in between the war and really once we get into the 1900s?
Well, in that long period after the Civil War, there was only one Democratic president elected to two non-consecutive terms, Grover Cleveland, and then in 1912 the election of Woodrow Wilson, who was significant in the shaping of the party in that. It was in his tenure that the country emerged as a world power, or at least a country that had to pay attention to what was going on elsewhere in the world. Wilson's attempt to create the United Nations and to bring the United States into the United Nations eventually caused his not only his political dissent, but his own death, trying to fight for the League of Nations when the Republican-controlled Senate would not go along. But in any event, you're correct that it was not until 1932 during the Depression that Franklin Roosevelt, with his very bold and experimental initiatives in dealing with the depressed economy, that the Democratic Party took on a new face, and that was a face of going back to the idea of a party of the people, using the federal government as an engine for social and economic change. That has been the stamp of the Democratic Party ever since, to various degrees.
And that's, it seems that there's a place where you can certainly see a fundamental change from the earlier Democratic Party. I didn't really mean to pass over Woodrow Wilson so easily, but particularly with Roosevelt and the New Deal, that it seems that there the party took on the quality, the characteristics that we now associate with it, and that made it such a dominant force in American politics from that point until. Well, I suppose until the 1990s, I guess.
Yeah, it's true that the New Deal really defined and redefined the Democratic Party as Roosevelt sought to find ways first to break out of the Depression and then to extend the middle class in the society through the various programs that came to be known as the New Deal. After his three years and some months terms, Harry Truman carried that on under a new label, the Fair Deal, and then the basic policies of the New Deal have survived with some tinkering ever since. Even in Republican administrations Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, although there was always strong rhetoric against the New Deal, nothing basic ever was done to derail the basic policies of the New Deal. We have seen with the growth of conservatism and the Reagan years an attempted turn away from that emphasis. And I think one of the things that that has really hurt the Democratic Party was that the Republican Party, especially under Richard Nixon, very effectively was able to demonize the Democratic Party with the word liberal, making liberal a dirty word, and put the defense of the Democratic Party distinctly on the defensive over its progressive agenda.
Yeah, and also that Nixon, I suppose some of the groundwork was laid by Barry Goldwater and his supporters, but Nixon, certainly his administration, also made it a priority to make inroads into what had been the traditional Democratic strongholds in the South.
Yes.
So that's where we see with this great reversal of power centers, so that and we see this loss of Democratic strength in the South.
That's absolutely true, and yet the Democratic Party still needs Southern support. It's notable that the last three Democratic presidents all came from the South.
At what point did substantial numbers of African Americans switch from the Republican Party, which, after all, was the party of Lincoln and really began as an anti-slavery party? At what point did substantial numbers of African Americans move and leave the Republican Party and become Democrats?
Well, it did really begin in the New Deal years. Although it's kind of interesting to note that Roosevelt himself was not particularly welcoming to black Americans. He resisted strongly efforts by the early civil rights leaders to get the Democratic Party, to get the federal government to take a more active role in dealing with some of the severe questions or problems of black Americans, particularly in terms of rights, legal rights. But nevertheless, it was under Roosevelt that the move began to take place. A lot of it was just because of economics, that black Americans were getting jobs. They were beginning to have a better life under Roosevelt, to the point that in some cases Roosevelt was really considered a god in black America, although in his own personal life didn't do much to deserve that. Actually, it was his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, who was a very goodwill ambassador to Black America and had a very sympathetic ear for Black Americans' concerns, and used her position to convey that to her sometimes reluctant husband.
I think that was among the things that they probably had a lot of arguments about, because she really pushed issues like that.
Exactly.
And he, because he was the guy that had to actually deal with the real political pressures.
He had a deal in those years with Democratic control of Congress. And every time the issue of advancing civil rights came to him, he would always plead that he couldn't do this or that because he needed to have that support of Southern Democrats.
Who do you think were the most influential Democratic presidents?
Well, certainly Jefferson, because of his founding role, and Jackson in bringing that populist tint to the party. But in terms of achievement, you'd have to say Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. Mm-hmm. But also, you'd have to say as well that Lyndon Johnson's very ambitious Great Society program, which picked up but went far beyond the proposals of John F. Kennedy, was an extremely strong president. If it hadn't been for the Vietnam War and his unwillingness to level with the American people about its cost and where it was going, I think he would certainly rank up high. I think that similarly, Bill Clinton, in terms of the economic conditions that greatly improved under his years, would rate highly, except for the scandal that smeared his presidency. Perhaps that will recede in years to come. We don't know. It's interesting that sometimes presidents who have certain perceived blemishes, those blemishes fade. That certainly has happened with Harry Truman, who was considered a victim or complicit in cronyism in his years, has emerged in terms of some of the great things that happened in his years, such as the Marshall Plan, to be regarded as one of the strong presidents.
Yeah, well, that's interesting what has happened with his image, that he's gone from a man who in his time was considered one of the least successful American presidents to the place where he is now, where there are people who would say that he was one of the more successful American presidents. In recent years, I think we have heard more and more people, and particularly I think you hear this from liberal Democrats, who say that there's less and less difference between the two parties. We'd certainly heard in the last election cycle is something that we heard a lot, and a lot of that, a responsibility for that, gets laid at the door of Bill Clinton for pulling the party more towards the center of the political spectrum. I guess one basic question I'm interested in your thoughts about is indeed whether there are still today clear differences between the parties.
Well, I think I always get very frustrated to hear that people argue that there's no difference. After all, the Democratic Party believes in the federal government and a forceful federal government, using the machinery of the federal government in the most idealistic terms, to improve the life of Americans, but particularly the disadvantaged Americans. The Republican Party very clearly believes that there's too much government, there are too many intrusions on the private sector, and that many, many problems are better left to the marketplace. So I think that's a clear difference between the two parties. Certainly, as the Democratic Party moved to the center under Clinton, that was somewhat blurred. But you're seeing now, in this approaching presidential election, those factions in the Democratic Party fighting out that argument.
Yeah, I think in as much as people have had that complaint about the parties, about not being enough difference between the parties, it does seem that at least recently the two parties have pulled farther apart, and that politics in Washington, and perhaps indeed that this goes back to 1994 when the Democrats took control of the Congress, that a lot of people have said, indeed, the Republicans, 1994, the Republicans took control of the Congress. There are people who argue that at that point, politics became much more partisan, more fiercely partisan than it had been, and that since that point it's just gotten more and more so.
Well, I would certainly not be able to disagree with that, that it has become much more partisan. I think it's also because we have, with the Republicans in control of both Congress and the White House, there's more determination to get their programs through. Well, the same was true in all those years on the other side when the Democrats were in control. There was cooperation on some things, but when push came to shove, the power was what determined what was done and wasn't done.
We're a little bit past our midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580, and we're talking with Jules Whitcover. He's a journalist. He's covered American politics and the Democratic Party for a long time as a reporter, a columnist, and author. He has written 10 books on politics and history. He has attended every Democratic convention since 1964, and he wrote about every campaign between 1976 and 1992. He's worked written for a number of papers, the LA Times, the Washington Post, and since 1981, he has been a political columnist for the Baltimore Sun, and is the author of a new book that is a history of the Democratic Party. It's titled Party of the People, A History of the Democrats. That's the subtitle. Random House is the publisher, and it's one of two books that are intended to be companions, that one looks at the history of the Democrats, the other looks at the history of the Republicans. And in fact, in the second hour of the show, the 11 o'clock hour of the show, we will be talking about the Republican Party, and there our guest will be Lewis Gould. He's a history professor at University of Texas at Austin, and has written this book, Grand Old Party, A History of the Republicans. So we'll be doing the same exercise there in our number two. And questions, welcome, of course, as always, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. The last new party to come along to have significant success in the United States was the Republican Party when Abraham Lincoln was elected president. And now certainly the two major parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, have managed to regulate the system. If you look at the way the laws that govern elections and the realities of campaign finance, to put themselves in a very strong position to continue to be the major parties. I know that some people are now arguing that parties have gotten so good at drawing electoral districts that there are almost no competitive races for the U.S. House anymore. And the fact the Supreme Court is hearing a case on that very issue about just how much is gerrymandering is too much. What do you think about the possibility that a third party would come along anytime soon and pose a serious challenge to the Democrats and the Republicans?
Well, I think it's extremely unlikely for the reasons that you have just enumerated. The machinery of elections is so arranged now that for a third party to get started and to get properly financed is extremely difficult, as we've seen with a number of third-party efforts. When Ross Perot ran, financed himself, dealt with one aspect of it, but nevertheless, it was extremely difficult to get on the ballot all over the country, and just to get into the debates, and so it's really the system is kind of stacked against third parties. But beyond that, I think that, and because of that, it will take a figure larger than anybody who we have seen come along yet who attempted the third-party route to really break through. My own feeling is that perhaps we've seen one person in the last 50 years or more who possibly could have done that, and that, to me, would have been Dwight Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. He was so hugely popular after World War II, and had the kind of calming personality, appealing personality, that possibly, just possibly, he might have been able to win on a third-party ticket. But we haven't seen anybody who has had that kind of appeal and resonated with the American people as a nonpartisan figure. Because although he was a Republican, he pretty much avoided the Republican label, even as a candidate and as a president. It would take somebody like that, and I'm afraid we don't have anybody in that position. This year, there was talk of Wesley Clark running as a third-party candidate because it wasn't clear whether he was a Democrat or a Republican. And although he has a distinguished war record, I don't think anybody would indicate that or suggest that he was at the level that Dwight Eisenhower was after World War II.
Hmm. We have a caller, and we'd certainly welcome others. We have someone here in Urbana. I'd like to talk with you on line number one. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to know, recently they've been saying that for both parties, the Hispanics in the country are important and are becoming increasingly important, and they want to court them and all that. I was wondering if you could kind of give a capsule summary of what that particular subgroup, what its importance has been to the Democratic Party over time, in its historical sense.
Well, it certainly has been strongly Democratic in most places. In Florida, however, with the influx of Cubans, that there has been a swing to Republicans among many of these people. But elsewhere in the country, it's remained strongly Democratic. There also have been some inroads in Texas. But on the other hand, the Republican cause of winning the Hispanic vote, in my opinion, was severely set back in California when then-Republican Governor Pete Wilson supported certain positions that would deprive the children of Hispanics education and other rights. So I think that is a problem that lingers for the Republican Party in California and perhaps elsewhere in trying to get a majority of the Hispanic vote.
So you're saying that Hispanics themselves have chosen to be Democrats for the most part. How about the Democratic Party? How have they done much in the way of, all this time that Democratic Party has been in existence? Hasn't all this attention been very recent? And they pretty much, took Hispanics for granted the whole time.
Oh, yeah, there's no question about that. And some would say they've also taken African Americans for granted because the sentiment in those two groups was so strongly Democratic that they didn't have to court them. But now that that the Republicans are making a strong effort, particularly among Latin Americans, Hispanics, that the Democratic Party cannot take them for granted any longer, and so it's quite a competition going on now to get that vote, which is getting more and more important. Projections indicate that eventually Hispanics could be a majority of the population in the country, and particularly as it grows in the Southwest.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions are welcome. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus with our guest, Jules Whitcover. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I think it's interesting you talk about block voting, that there is this difference between Latinos and African Americans, that Latinos are divided. There are some, for example, as you say, Cuban Americans tend to be Republicans, and perhaps Mexican Americans tend to be Democrats. So it can go one way or the other. As far as African Americans are concerned, it seems to be still the most reliable group for the Democrats. Is that something that you think is there is some possibility for change? Because it seems that the Republicans have to date had very little success in trying to persuade African Americans to support the Republican Party.
I don't see much possibility of a basic change in that, particularly with a very conservative administration. Whether it's justified or not, the view of the Republican Party in the African American community is one of a hostile body against them, and it's going to take a lot more work to get that constituency into the Republican column than it will be probably to recruit Hispanics.
I think we had another caller getting set up here on our toll-free line. Someone, I think, near Indianapolis, line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I was wanting to get the impression or ask the question with regard to the Democratic Party's issue or position on cultural issues and how that has affected their popularity, with the idea being that had they been more mainstream with regard to cultural issues, they might still be the dominant party. And that's my question.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And it seems, I know that some people believe that, in fact, some of these kinds of issues are likely to be big issues in the presidential race next year.
Well, what specific issues is the caller talking about under the label cultural issues?
Well, the caller rang off, but I my guess it would be things like perhaps abortion, school prayer, funding for religious schools, gay marriage, you know, all of those kinds of wedge issues that tend to be sharply divisive. That's my guess.
All those sound to me like religious issues rather than cultural, but in any event, one of the big issues talked about currently is this whole question about the recognition of gay marriage and or civil unions. I know the conventional wisdom is that this is going to be a huge issue in the 2004 election, but my own sense is that it will not be such a determinative issue, because I think people are becoming more open about their attitudes and more concerned about the individual rights. So I think that it at best it may be an issue that that is a wash in terms of the country. Mm. That there'll be just as many people who will tolerate and support gay rights and gay marriage and particularly civil union than those. Than those who oppose them.
Hmm. Well, I suppose there are some people who would make the argument that the country generally has become more conservative, but that the Democrats, particularly because they need to hold on to their base, have continued to lean sort of to the left, particularly on those issues that are considered to be cultural or religious or, you know, whatever you want to call them, those kind of issues. And for that reason, that's been part of the reason that part of the reason for Republican success, lack of Democrat success, particularly over the last decade, let's say.
Yeah, I think that's probably so. You're going to see in the fight for the Democratic nomination less emphasis on those questions, because the people who participate mostly in Democratic primaries are liberal activists, and I don't think they want to fight for the nomination over those issues. In fact, there isn't that much difference among the candidates on those issues. It'll be another question as you get into the general election, where there is a sharp difference between President Bush as a conservative on these issues and whomever becomes the Democratic nominee.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some other callers. We have someone on a cell phone. This will be line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering, I'm Native American, and do you have any information about the influence of the Native American in the United States on any of the political parties, or are they such a small demographic that they are insignificant?
Well, unfortunately, they're not insignificant, but they haven't developed the kind of clout that will drive either of the parties. It's kind of an issue that weighs on the conscience of both parties, but not sufficiently to do anything significant about it. That's actually one of the scandals of American politics, particularly as observed out of this country, that we could have such an important group of Americans whose rights seem to be treated very cavalierly.
I was afraid of that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Is it? Do we know that that Native Americans tend predominantly more to identify with one or the other party?
Yeah, I think they do tend to vote Democratic, but it also could depend on what part of the country they're from.
We have some other callers. We have two more here. They're in Chicago, so we'll take them in the order they came in. First, we'll go to line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I'm just really amazed by the hoopla about George Al Gore supporting Howard Dean. Al Gore didn't even win his own state, which even George McGovern was able to do, besides which most of the people, especially African Americans, just found Mr. Bush so repugnant that they voted for Al Gore. But he really has no charisma and no following. So how does this no-impact person give another no-impact person a great deal of credence? I just really feel that we're going to have four more years of Mr. Bush, not because he's unbeatable, but because the Democrats are so beatable.
Well, it was interesting that there was a debate in New Hampshire. I'm calling from New Hampshire, and there was a debate here last night. And the first question was Ted Koppel, who was the moderator, asked each of them to raise their hand if they thought that Howard Dean could beat George Bush, and the only person who raised his hand was Howard Dean. But as for the whole question of Al Gore's influence, I think you have to remember that he won 500,000 votes more than George W. Bush in 2000. So there are some people out there who still have a lot of respect for him. Beyond that, the hoopla about the endorsement reflected a recognition that Gore, as an establishment Democrat, an insider, gave some support to a candidate who was run pretty much as an insurgent in the Democratic Party, as Howard Dean has done. So I don't think you can brush aside the fact that the endorsement is going to be of some help in the Democratic nomination fight. Will be some help to Dean in helping to convince establishment Democrats that he's acceptable.
But establishment Democrats are not enough to put him into office, and he has not won any of the primaries as it stands.
Well, they haven't happened yet.
Right, and I doubt if he can. And I think that maybe establishment Democrats need to look a little bit more carefully if they truly want to win.
Well, who would you suggest?
Well, the only person I see worth voting for is Al Sharpton. But what they have now, Mr. Bush is going to win. That's all I can say. There is just no way that any of those men up there, especially Howard Dean, could win, because I think that the Democrats will probably impale themselves on the gay marriage issue, because what the Republicans did during the last campaign was they went very heavily after conservative Catholics who were normally Democratic on what this other guy was calling cultural issues, but they made a very strong push. I know in Illinois there was a radio station, a religious radio station created for Catholics, which was mainly to push for Mr. Bush, and right after the elections the station went off the air. So if the Democrats can't pull themselves together and get someone who's much more appealing, so that they can override issues, they're just not going to win.
The only thing I would suggest to that is that one of the things about the Dean campaign is that through the very clever industrious use of the internet, they have not only raised money, but they have brought many, many thousands of people who have not been involved in the process before. If he could succeed in changing the universe of voters heavily in his favor, that is bringing more and more Democrats into the ranks, then an election that was decided last time by only 500,000 votes, or was undecided by 500,000 votes, that the influx of all these new people that Dean is attempting to bring into the party could make a difference. And as somebody who's been covering presidential politics for longer than I'd like to think, I've learned never to rule anything out. There were those who, at this stage of the game, said Jimmy Carter was a joke in 1975, 76, and had no prayer. So you never can tell what's going to happen in a dynamic society of ours.
New voters can only matter if you keep the old voters.
Well, I don't think that's so much the problem. This is one of the things that Al Gore may be able to help Howard Dean in keeping the old voters.
Well, I wouldn't count on it, but thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. We'll try real quick to get one more. This is also Chicago, line two. Hello.
Yeah, this whole idea that the Republicans want less government, isn't that really a fallacy?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
The idea that the Republicans want less government, that's really a fallacy. Because they
it looks that way because we've had a growth in the federal establishment and certainly more spending under this president.
Right. And they want more restriction and more infringing on rights. I mean, that's not less government.
Yeah, well, that's I can't argue with that.
And that really didn't that really, at least as far as this issue of size of government, didn't that really begin with Ronald Reagan, who campaigned on the idea of smaller government, and yet when he got into office, it didn't happen.
Well, that's one of the wonders of politics and the ability to one of Ronald Reagan's great talents was that whatever he said he said it with such conviction that people tended to believe it, and sometimes he tended to believe things that he said that weren't so.
Well, I think we're going to have to wrap up this hour, but I'm sure we'll get into some of the same materials, same themes in the next hour as we talk about the Republicans with Lewis Gold. But Mr. Whitcover, I certainly want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our guest, Jules Whitcover, he's a journalist. He's been covering American politics and the Democratic Party for quite a long time. He attended every Democratic convention since 1964, and he wrote about every campaign from 76 to 92. Since 1981, he's been a political columnist for the Baltimore Sun, and he makes his home in Washington, D.C. And if you're interested in reading about the history of the Democratic Party, he is the author of a brand new book that's published by Random House that's titled Party of the People. It's out there in bookstores now if you want to take a look at it. And it is intended to be a companion to another book, which is also just out, also from Random House, and it is The History of the Republicans. And that book is titled Grand Old Party. And in the next hour of Focus 580, we will be talking with the author of that book. His name is Lewis Gould. He's a professor emeritus in American history at the University of Texas at Austin. So we'll hope that you will stick around, and we'll continue to talk about American politics in the next part of Focus 580.